Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde with Seattle Broadcasting's answer to Rachel Maddow, Erica C. Barnett of Publicola.
You know, she follows me on Blue Sky.
Are you serious? That is so cool.
It's my claim to fame.
Oh my God.
Well, maybe she's a listener.
That's why she's so annoying.
Also with us, Seattle's answer to Chris Wallace, political consultant Sandeep Kaushik.
Chris Wallace. I'm more Mike Wallace, I think, age-wise anyway.
Or Mike Royko.
Mike Royko, that's a compliment. I would die to be seen as Mike Royko.
On today's show, we're going to be talking about a new progressive business tax. But first, a proposed initiative that would ban unauthorized public camping in our area and aspires to do some other things down the road. Erica, backers claim that they've got polling that shows that this thing has support. But in your write-up, you at one point used the phrase out of step with King County values. What would this initiative do and why did you use that phrase?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see if it's out of step with King County values if it gets on the ballot. But it's, you know, as you sort of alluded, it's a fairly limited initiative. It's to ban, you know, so-called camping in unincorporated King County. So not specifically in Seattle, but it's kind of modeled off of other similar initiatives in San Diego and also closer to home in Burien that, you know, would essentially completely ban sleeping outdoors anywhere in unincorporated King County, make it a misdemeanor and put, you know, subject people to potential arrest. There are some outs in the law that say, you know, shelter has to be available. But much like Seattle's law on encampment sweeps, actually, it has some caveats that would allow sweeps or arrests if shelter isn't available in cases where somebody is causing an obstruction or, you know, posing a harm to themselves or others. And that's pretty vaguely defined. So it could open the door to broad arrests of people who happen to be unsheltered in unincorporated King County. And, you know, and I think kind of if it passes, we'll open the door to similar initiatives around the area. So pretty limited in scope so far, but the ambitions of the backers, and I should say the primary supporter is Saul Spady, who's a former Cairo host and the grandson of Dick's Burgers founder. Their ambitions are much broader if this initiative passes.
So, Erica, before I dive into my thoughts on this, like, I know you talked to Saul Spady about his initiative, and what was your sense that you got from him about how likely this is to actually qualify for the ballot? Are they going to have the resources to get it there? It sounds like maybe it doesn't need as many signatures as you might have guessed to actually kind of qualify something like this.
Yeah, it was interesting. So there's conflicting information on their website, which might have caused some confusion. It said they needed about 50,000. But in fact, I talked to King County Elections and Saul Spady, as you mentioned, and they only need about 7,000 from unincorporated King County to pass this. But, you know, interestingly, I talked to him about how signature gathering was going, and he said it was pretty you know, it was going okay. I think he was a little bit concerned, maybe concerned is overstating it, but he said that it is hard to collect signatures in unincorporated King County because it is quite rural in some areas and suburban. You know, it's you're traveling long distances, you're knocking on doors. It's not quite as easy as standing on a street corner in Seattle, you know, with a tent or whatever, or with a clipboard and collecting signatures on the street. So I think that 6,000, 7,000 signatures is not that many, however. So, you know, I could see this qualifying. I could see it not qualifying. I think Saul Spady was, unlike what you might expect, was very much of a mind that, you know, maybe this is the solution, maybe it's not, but we're going to try it. And, you know, and was, I would say, surprisingly kind of humble about some of the other goals of the Quality of Life Coalition, which is the name of the new group, have. And those include, you know, more ambitious things like forcing people into rehab. I mean, you know, just a lot more sort of far-reaching conservative goals. And when I talked to him, you know, he was like, well, you know, I don't know if those are the right solutions. It's just kind of what we're putting out there. Now, I would say, from my perspective, as someone who is an advocate for harm reduction, I mean, these are very potentially harmful solutions. One of the things that they've proposed is putting people in jail for 5 years automatically if they are caught dealing fentanyl or meth, those two specific drugs. So, you know, I think a lot of this stuff is pretty sketchy. And so, I mean, sketchy in the sense that it's not very fleshed out yet, and it's high level proposals, but yeah, I mean,
you reported, Eric, it's mandatory 5 years in jail for anyone caught dealing just those drugs, unless that person is themselves addicted to just those drugs. It's by just those drugs.
Well, it's interesting. That's what I mean when I say it's sketchy. So a lot of the stuff, I mean, Spady was like, you know, maybe this is what it's going to be. Maybe it's not. I think it depends on what happens with this initial initiative, if it makes it on the ballot, if it passes. But, I wouldn't be surprised if something like this were to pass, if it's on the ballot, because I think that there is a big push against kind of harm reduction, housing first policies right now. And obviously, we're seeing camping bans in parts of the region that we might not expect them, like in Burien. So the vibe right now is very anti-housing first.
Why, just before we get back to the housing first piece, and Sandy, you'll jump in, but why mandatory 5 years in jail? It's already illegal to deal drugs. So what problem is he trying to solve?
Yeah, I made that point, and I think his argument was that these drugs are so uniquely dangerous and they're causing such harm in our communities that 5 years seems like a good compromise between no years or, you know, whatever amount is currently available. I think 5 years is, it is possible to jail drug dealers for 5 years now under felony statutes. But Trump has proposed, I believe, 10 years mandatory. And I think he was saying that this is less than what the Trump administration is proposing. So, again, I mean, I think this is all kind of seat of the pants kind of proposals and not very well thought through. But that's the reasoning that he gave.
And to be clear, this sort of 5-year mandatory minimums thing is not actually what they're pushing forward right now. This is sort of perspective, as you say, not fleshed out future stuff that maybe they want to do. I will just say on that front, I don't support mandatory minimums like that of one size fits all. We've done that in the past. It's led to, you know, bad results. Like, that was kind of war on drug stuff. But I think if you talk to Saul Spady,
you don't want to put Jesse in jail right away in Breaking Bad. You want to wait until later.
Well, I just want to. Yeah,
it's the first time he's selling a little bit of whatever.
Yeah. I mean,
you want the judge to have some discretion. Why shouldn't judges have discretion?
I want there to be some discretion. Yeah. Yes. I don't want to just throw a one size fits all approach on how we enforce, you know, drug laws. Right. I don't think that worked in the past, and I don't think it'll work in the future. So I'm not on board with that. I do think, though, to be fair to Saul here, I think what he would say is, like in King County, that the courts have been very lenient about drug dealing in a lot of cases where people are selling these drugs. And there hasn't been, you know, in his mind, enough of a kind of enforcement side, right? But enough of a penalty for getting caught for dealing drugs. I think I should say I had a conversation with Saul now several months ago now, where he talked to me about these ideas, including this initiative that is now going forward, and showed me some polling that they had done. And, you know, his polling says that these ideas, like this camping ban in unincorporated King County, is very, very popular, right? Like, he had it north of 75% support. Now, the nuance here is we're talking about unincorporated King County, right? Which is, it is the kind of rural part of the county. It's not just Seattle's exempted, but all of the 39, you know, the other 38 or 39 suburban cities are exempted too. So we're talking about the most rural, probably the most, you know, the least progressive parts of the county, right, as being the universe of folks.
Oh, Sandeep, you almost said that somebody in the world is conservative. You almost admitted that they're conservative people.
They voted for Biden, probably, but in East Renton, but they're...
Well, there are conservatives in the rural parts of King County. Yes, yes. I don't like the use of that word to, you know, reference anybody who doesn't subscribe to the left progressive agenda in Seattle, which is sort of the default that progressives use. And it pisses me off when I see the media repeat it, because I think they're just they're taking sides, right? When they do that, they're.
Hey, I'm the media. I take sides.
Well, you are. You're the media, but you're the problem media. You do take sides. You're on a side, right? But at least you're open about your side. I don't like it when the Seattle Times adopts your framing. Is I guess my point.
I think, to be fair, we both talked to Saul. I talked to Saul and I will be, you know, as fair as possible. Like I told him I disagree with a lot of these policy proposals that are like not actually in the initiative. I mean, I don't think a public camping ban, is a good idea. I don't think arresting people for being homeless is a solution to homelessness. And I also don't think, I mean, one of the things he said was like, you know, this will light a fire under people's asses to provide shelter and to actually, I mean, I think he was saying that we should focus more on shelter than on housing because of the, you know, acuity of the problem. I don't think that the prospect of throwing homeless people in jail has ever motivated elected officials to start spending a whole bunch of money on shelter or services. I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that has ever happened in this region or probably anywhere. But that is kind of what he described as his thinking to me. So I don't think he's just like being, you know, I don't think he thinks of himself as just being punitive here. But I think that would be the effect.
Well, what's weird is why not include, like, if you're going to talk about wanting to open thousands of new low barrier shelter beds, like tiny homes, and you're going to have some kind of unauthorized public camping ban, why wouldn't you pair the two? I don't get why if you're actually serious.
Because that would require a tax. I mean, and that's okay. And a tax is not a conservative solution.
It's not a serious idea, I don't think. I mean, you know, to me, it's like, it's just not a very serious idea. It's like, we're just going to, I mean, I'm not saying it wouldn't pass. Maybe it will pass, but.
Well, I mean, it's happening in California. I mean, I don't consider this, you know, a solution by any means, but I mean, it is very common in the sort of pendulum of politics for right-wing solutions, you know, quote-unquote solutions to be very popular. And so, I mean, I think that we might be going in the direction more of punitive camping bans. I mean, we'll see what happens in the Seattle elections, obviously, and maybe Seattle will be a bit more of an outlier. But right now, I mean, sweeps are incredibly common, you know, with or without notice. They're becoming more common. And so I don't think that a pro-sweeps policy is going to be unpopular in King County.
Right. I'm not sure a pro-sweeps policy is unpopular in Seattle, right? We adjudicated this in recent elections and it turned out it wasn't. You know, the stop the sweep stuff from the left is what I think sort of helped torpedo them in recent election cycles. Maybe it's changed. I will say this. I think Saul has a point when he says the acuity of the problem with unsheltered homelessness on the streets of our cities and apparently our rural areas as well in unincorporated King County requires us that we should be thinking more about investing in various forms of enhanced or low barrier shelter, you know, even if that means spending less on housing so that we can address the immediate circumstance of people living on the streets. I think that there's an argument there to be made that's not silly or not wrong. And to bring up the California example, I've been obsessed with the mayor of San Jose, Matt Mahan, who is sort of, I think, the tip of the spear of some of the changes that have been happening in California blue cities. And Mahan has this controversial proposal that he had put forward where he says, we're going to offer people, he said, and he repurposed a bunch of housing money to build a shitload of like tiny homes and enhanced shelter, motels, buying all that stuff. He's opening up 1,400 units of enhanced shelter in 1 year. And he's offering that shelter to unhoused people on the streets of San Jose. But the flip side of it is if you refuse offers of shelter 3 times, then you are subject to arrest on the streets of San Jose. And he says, he was on our other podcast a couple months ago, Blue City Blues, and he said to us, I don't want to put those people in jail, but they got to go to drug court. They got to go to mental health court. If you're not accepting low barrier shelter alternatives repeatedly, and we have them and I'm building them, then you can't camp on our streets and you got to get your underlying problems addressed and I'm going to push you into doing it, right? That seems to be the model for some of the stuff that folks like Saul are
Yeah, I mean, it's coercion, and it's depriving people of civil liberties. I mean, that is the alternative that you were talking about and that Saul is talking about. I mean, there are civil liberties involved when you say you have to go to this place. You're calling them units. I mean, they're not units. I think that we have really slipped in our language about shelter and what it is. There are reasons that people don't want to go to shelter. We've talked about them many times, and forcing people coercively to choose between shelter and jail is, you know, it's not a choice always. And I think it's a very simplistic way of thinking about human beings that, you know, we don't apply to ourselves as housed people, but in the dehumanization of homeless people, we think that it's okay.
Well, first of all, in the San Jose example, to be very, very clear here, we're not talking about mats on the floor congregate shelter, right? The old shelter that the progressive left said was inadequate, and there's reasons people don't want to go. It's crowded. It's sometimes dangerous. It's, you know.
I don't think that it was just the progressive left saying I think it was homeless people.
Well, right. And the
people that you're dismissing as not experts on their own experience.
And I was in agreement with that, right? Look, I'm a DSC ran the main shelter in the city of Seattle since 1979, right? And the second floor of the Morrison Hotel, it's not open anymore, but because of it closed during the pandemic. But for 40 years, more than 40 years, it was the primary shelter in the city of Seattle. And it was crowded and freaky and sometimes dangerous. It was very hard to manage because you have all those people with all those issues kind of in close proximity. And it wasn't mapped on the floor per se that it started that way, but it was these very crowded, small bunk beds that were kind of jammed together in this one huge room. And, you know, and it was understandable why people might not want to stay there. But the shelter we're talking about right now in the San Jose example are things like tiny homes, motels, as it's four walls and a door kind of shelter, right? So not the old form of shelter, but this new, more shelter that allows for more privacy and bringing stuff there. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
But let's just be clear. Like, not everything works for everybody for various reasons, and it is coercive. And I do think that's the direction we're going in. I think it's a bad direction because I think human beings have human rights.
You don't have a human right to camp on the streets of a city, right? I mean, that's not really the question of, I mean, this is what we're adjudicating.
You have a human right to fall asleep. I mean, this is what we're adjudicating. I disagree that when there is not adequate housing, that we have the right as a society to force people into, you know, whatever kind of shelter it is, whether it's cubicles, whether it's, you know, a motel somewhere.
I wonder what percentage of people wouldn't prefer like a tiny home to having to sleep on the street, a tiny home where the door locked or something like that, where you could keep your possessions and like where you felt safer and you didn't have to worry about somebody attacking you. And I don't know. I just wonder what
it's a matter of providing the option as opposed to forcing people to choose between that and jail. And
in any case, this is not what Saul Spady has proposed so far. He's hinting that this is something that would somehow happen as a result of his camping ban, right?
Well, I just want to say one thing also to Sandeep, I mean, about like, well, you know, it might just mean that we have to build less housing. I mean, it's just interesting that housing and shelter are seen as like sort of part of a zero-sum ecosystem where you can't have money coming from any other source like police. And the idea of, you know, for example, taking some money from unfilled police positions that are sitting vacant is like so out of, you know, just absolutely out of the realm of possibility or just any other source. It's housing, shelter that exists as, you know, a static amount of money. And we can balance between the two, but we can't ever, you know, invest more resources into both. Housing is incredibly expensive to build, and it takes a long time, and we definitely need more shelter. 100% agree, and we need options that people want to go into. But, I mean, the idea that it's zero sum.
But we can't possibly build enough of the kind of permanent supportive housing, for example, that DESC is building for all of the people who might need it, can we? I mean, is it even possible to build that much? Is there enough money to do that? Like, I wish there were, but it's
is there
like
enough money? I mean, I think that's such a big philosophical question, David. Like, of course there's enough money in our region. We have, you know, billionaires in this region. Yes, there is enough money.
But it's more than the entire city budget times two or whatever to build that much housing.
Mark Doan's put forward at King County RHA here's what it would take to do that. And it was the price tag was $12 billion, right, of Mark's plan. And Eric, as I recall, you kind of rolled your eyes at that too, right? That we're never getting $12 billion in funding. I mean, that's like bigger than the size.
That's a political reality, but it's not. I mean, David's question was different. Is it impossible? I mean, politically, yes, it's impossible.
It's bigger than the size of the entire city budget.
I should not have said impossible. It's not impossible that we could all move to the moon. When you think about it, it's possible, but it's not likely to happen. It's an astronomical amount of money that would be difficult to come up with.
I mean, will we always have homelessness? Yes. I mean, yes, David, in reality, we will always have homelessness. Jail is probably the worst solution and the most expensive that we could choose to address that.
Capitol Hill blog has a story up too about Rachel Savage, the long shot candidate for position 8, filing a similar initiative in the city of Seattle. If anything happens with that, we'll keep you posted here on Seattle Nice. Let's move on now to talk about a topic that's near and dear to all of our hearts, business taxes. And in this case, progressive business taxes. This is something where we saw a sort of interesting political alliance between Alexis Mercedes Rink and right-wing mayor Bruce Harrell. Erica, how is that even possible? The two of them got together and proposed a progressive business tax. What would this tax do before we talked about the latest developments?
Hey, Seattle Nice listeners. Seattle politics got you low? Well, get high with Uncle Ike's. Pissed at the mayor? Relax with a dollar joint. Pop a tire in a pothole? Eat a $2 gummy and chill. Whether you need something to pump you up for Saturday's protest or a mellow strain for your next sit-in, Ike's is your best friend. Now is the time to roll up, Seattle. Download the Ike's app today or head on over to Ike's.com. That's Ike's.com.
It would exempt, so it includes a tax exemption on the business and occupation tax up to $2 million in gross revenues for all businesses. And above that, it increases the amount for about 10% of businesses. So this is the highest grossing businesses in the city of Seattle. And it, as you said, it came from Alexis Mercedes Rink on the city council, progressive city council member. And Mayor Bruce Harrell, and they proposed it a couple weeks ago. And then this week, there were a bunch of amendments that came down from other city council members.
Right. And it raises a net $90 million a year, even after you kind of exempt a bunch of these smaller businesses. It's a significant revenue increase, right? It's $90 million annually is real money, right? So it's about a 25% increase in the BO for these kind of 2 million and above businesses, the larger businesses.
Yeah. And the idea is that these revenues would go to pay for things. I mean, according to the sort of pitch on the initiative, which does have to go to voters, is that it would increase funding for things that the Trump administration is planning to cut. What that looks like in reality is that it would backfill general fund support for things like housing, homelessness, human services, and small business supports, gender-based violence services, things like that. Food access is another area. So it's a revenue backfill for what's expected to be at least a $240 million budget shortfall over the next couple of years.
And just to be clear, it says, I'm reading, 90% of all businesses will actually pay less. So it's a truly progressive business tax.
Yeah, that's a little bit of, yes, technically that is true. But like little businesses of the ones it's exempting tend to pay, the B&O tax is not a significant hit. Even for the larger businesses, it's not the really, you know, biggest taxes that they pay in the city of Seattle. But for little businesses that aren't generating a whole lot of gross revenue, the amount of tax is pretty de minimis. So yeah, they're getting exempted, but they weren't paying a whole lot before. I mean, maybe they're saving a
This is what the Chamber of Commerce has been agitating for, though, we should say. So Sunday, if you're dismissing it, but the Seattle Metro Chamber has been advocating for this exact exemption for a number of years. So they are getting part of what they want.
I'm for the, it's not a whole lot of cost to it. And It's not, you know, if a small business saves a little business saves $1,000 and B&O taxes every year, I'm okay with that.
I mean, a business that grosses $2 million, I would not call that a little business necessarily. It could be a business with a small margin, but I am a little business at Publicola and I do not gross $2 million. I'll just say that.
I know, but you and I both, you know, when you were away, we did a whole episode, I think, on this, and you, as well as I did, expressed some skepticism both about the quote unquote Trump proofing piece of this, as well as some of the claims that are being made to justify it.
Let's get to the latest news. Erica C. Barnett.
Yeah. So this week, as I put it in the headline, the city council larded it with new tax exemptions and added a bunch of new spending categories, sort of Christmas treeing the bill with a bunch of new stuff that it could possibly pay for, including transportation, which I think is kind of the farthest from the original intent of the bill. And there's also a couple of very specific tax exemptions that Maritza Rivera added for Seattle Children's Hospital and Fred Hutch Cancer Center. And those collectively, along with a tax exemption that Dan Strauss wants to add for stevedoring, will remove about $11 million from that $90 million revenue tag. So basically giving special tax exemptions to specific hospitals and business areas, and then adding some other areas of spending to this $90 million, which, you know, it is a lot of money. It's not that much money. I mean, again, it's about a third of the projected revenue shortfall for the next couple years. So the more you take out of it and the more you add onto how it can be spent, I mean, it's just kind of like peanut buttering it around to more and more things. So it'll have less impact on the original areas that it was supposed to help out.
I've said this before and I'll say it again. This feels like this thing was rushed forward, I think, for political reasons as much as any kind of real policy reasons. And it still feels to me a lot like a tax looking for a problem to solve, right? It was clear, as we know now, like the mayor's race is a real race, right, between Katie Wilson and Bruce Harrell. And I think that was dawning on the mayor and his team a month or two ago, which led to this sort of, you know, seemed somewhat rushed effort to push forward this new tax. There was no stakeholdering process that went into this. There was no kind of analysis of how best we should like deploy any new resources we get to kind of get maximal results. There was just a kind of like, let's roll this out and here's a spending wish list of like, you know, favored progressive groups and stuff that we want to throw some money at. And oh yeah, and by the way, this is about the budget deficit too. And, you know, so it's kind of like a tax first and figure it all out later sort of approach.
I would disagree with that. Alexis Mercedes Rink's office was working on this for months before proposing it. I mean, I would say if anything, you know, what it looks like is that Harrell kind of jumped onto this because of a need to, you know, appear to support some progressive stuff because Katie Wilson is hammering him from the left. But I mean, this was worked on, and I mean, the stuff that it funds, it's not favored progressive groups or whatever.
It sort of is.
It's food banks. It's, I mean, if you watch the meetings, you can see exactly who shows up to speak in favor of it. And it's, I mean, I don't know who you think it is, but it is, you know, this is going to pay primarily for things like, you know, people who are going hungry because of things like cuts to SNAP. So there is a nexus. I mean, to say that it's just, you know, sort of made up money and made up spending is, I think, inaccurate.
Maybe SNAP is, you know, the federal level of SNAP is, a lot of these Trump cuts so far are prospective. Right. I mean, I think there's real reason to be concerned about Trump cuts. I do think the Trump administration is, you know, slashing and burning the fucking federal government in ways that are going to have downstream impacts on localities like Seattle. And they are, in some cases, targeting blue jurisdictions like Seattle. I think we're going to talk about the lawsuit, right, that just got filed in part because of that. And so there's some reality. There's some reality there, but a lot of this has not happened yet, and it's perspective. And so
are budgets. budgets perspective too. It's for the next 2 years. So should the city not prepare for that?
This can't be like we're going to backfill federal cuts and we're going to use this to solve our existing budget deficit. Which is it? Like, you know,
is the mayor getting the political benefit here, Erica, do you think? I mean, is he being seen as a champion of progressive taxes as a result of this and eating into Katie Wilson's support? I mean, is he getting anything out of it? If it was politically motivated?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible to quantify, you know, how any one thing affects it. I don't think that a B&O tax is like lighting the world on fire. I do want to respond to what Sandeep said. Yes, it's the pitch, as I said, is this is for Trump cuts. The reality is that it is backfilling general fund shortfall, but it is focusing on the subject areas that are going to be subject to Trump cuts. And to say that, like, we should have a prospective 2-year budget that doesn't acknowledge the reality that we are going to face cuts from the Trump administration because, hey, it hasn't happened yet. I mean, that's not how the city does anything. The city always budgets prospectively and looks at economic revenue forecasts. I mean, to say that we shouldn't be thinking about the impact of the Trump cuts is like saying we shouldn't look at revenue forecasts either, because who knows? Everything could totally change. I mean, we have to live in reality.
Well, Sandeep, let me ask you the same question I asked Erica. Does Bruce Harrell get any benefit from this politically that you can see? Champion of progressive taxes, Bruce Harrell. I'm just not seeing that headline anywhere. But it does seem he's also trying some other efforts here. Seattle suing Trump administration as funding cuts threaten programs. So he's desperately trying to, you know, I don't want to say dig himself out of a hole, but make sure that he's in this race come November.
I don't know. But, well, we'll talk about the lawsuit in a second. To your larger question about whether him hopping on this B&O thing has helped him politically, I don't know, but I kind of doubt it. I'd say he's certainly not getting any credit from the left on it. And I think I certainly hear for those who are involved in the independent expenditure effort to, you know, the campaign that's raising outside money to support his reelection, I have heard that fundraising for that has been more tepid and some of the big donors have kind of stepped back, in part because they're frustrated with the mayor overdoing this. And so I guess what I would say is I think there's a reason for people on Team Harrell in that camp to be concerned that he might be ending up in that horrible no man's land politically that, you know, I would call it the Andrew Lewis zone, right? Like where you end up in this kind of place where you've blurred yourself ideologically to the point that neither side claims you or is really supportive of you. And
well, I mean, and if people are actually pulling out, that's not the headline. The headline is he's getting, as he is so far, a lot more PAC backing than Katie Wilson is.
Yeah, he is. But is it at the same level as it was 4 years ago? Right. I don't think so. And I do think that there are some of the donors that gave last time that are conspicuously absent, and some of the $25,000 checks for that aren't coming in. But I think it's less about the money and more it's about, like, is the mayor is in danger of putting himself in a place where he doesn't have a constituency, right? Where there's like this chasm that's opened up between the left and the center left. And it's, you don't want to get into a place where neither side feels good about you, right? And that's a dangerous place to be politically. And so I think that's the bigger worry here.
What you're saying is you think he's moved too far to the left and the center doesn't support him. I mean, not that the left ever supported Bruce Harrell. I mean, it's Chamber of Commerce money, it's business money, it's, you know, money from Republican donors that's not coming in again.
Again, it's less about the money, it's more about the voters. I worry that the enthusiasm for Bruce Harrell has been tempered because people don't have a good feel for where he is or what he's doing or where he's headed.
I mean, I just think it's funny, like, that is an accurate criticism of Bruce Harrell that could be applied at any time in his, you know, very, very long career in Seattle politics. I mean, we could have, you know, been saying that back in, you know, I don't know, 2012.
In which case, he's a lot more successful than you would have thought.
Oh, for sure. 100%, David.
Bruce Harrell has always been a politician that has worked to conciliate both the center and at least some elements of the left, right? And look at how he's conducted himself as the mayor over the last few years. This is why he got this is why progressive labor unions have all got on board, because he's actually given them something over the course of this term.
Right. That's what I was going to say. He still has progressive labor union backing. That's part of the point of the finance piece, right?
That's right. And I talked to someone in progressive labor in the last few days, asked them, with this Katie Wilson surge, are they wavering in their support for Bruce? And essentially the answer I got was, no, we're sticking with Bruce. We may even spend some money in the general election to support Bruce Harrell. We're not going to spend millions, you know, like huge amounts of money, but it sounds like, you know, his progressive labor support is staying firm for now. We'll see how things develop. But he always has been a politician that tries to kind of walk a line between the center and the left. That said, when he ran in 2021, he ran very much on, I'm going to clean up encampments. I'm going to, like, no more camping in parks, no more of this sort of COVID era, you know, batshittery. I'm going to add more cops. We're going to restore public safety, right?
Yeah, public health is just so crazy. We should have shoved all those homeless people into facilities.
I want to say one thing, which is that he is celebrating or touting the fact that they hired 100 cops right now. He hasn't completely moved away from that.
No, that's what I mean. But yes. And he has a good story to tell about some of the things that they have accomplished. And I think his campaign is trying very hard to remind people of what things were like 4 years ago and how they are now, and saying things have improved and you should reward me for that. My worry, though, is because of the anxiety around Trump and the stuff we've just been talking about, voters are more worried about the future right now than they are willing to kind of think about the past. And so if you're not offering a perspective answer to problems looking forward, they may not be willing to kind of be like, oh, things are better than they were, therefore I'm going to give you credit.
So, David, your original question, which we haven't quite gotten back to, is about the lawsuit. And my take on that, if we can wind all the way back there, is that it is much more something that Ann Davison is doing than something Bruce Harrell is doing. I think, you know, in contrast to Bruce, Ann is very much in trouble. Bruce is in trouble too, but I think Ann Davison is, you know, fairly likely to lose re-election at this point. I don't think she's likely to get primaried out, as much as it would be interesting to see that happen. You know, two of the three people that are running against her move forward instead. But, you know, by suing the Trump administration, I mean, I think Ann Davison, who, you know, ran as a Republican on the ticket that Trump headed in 2020, is trying to distance herself from him. And she's done this in the past with press releases. But they had a big event this week that I attended where, you know, Davison said some tepid words about wanting to protect the rule of law. The things that they're suing on are DEI executive order and the gender executive order, which basically say that cities that have DEI and cities that recognize the existence of trans people will not get federal funds if they do that as, official policy. And so they're suing on those two things. The timing, you know, on this was obviously timed for the election. I don't think that Bruce Harrell said there's nothing political about it, but these executive orders are months old. They date back to January. They're suing now. And I think, you know, Ann Davison is hoping this will sort of make her appear to be less of a Republican than she actually is, and less MAGA aligned than the Republican Party that she is part of is. And, you know, I don't know that it'll work. we're very, very late in the game. I think people have their minds made up, but I really felt that it was much more for Davison than for Harrell.
You know, Sandeep, actually the poll numbers for Ann Davison in the latest MPI poll, they weren't as bad as I was expecting. Ann Davison 30%, Eric Evans 16%, 48% undecided. So, but she's in some ways not doing that much worse than Bruce Harrell, it seems like, at least compared to her opponent.
Yeah, I don't know that Ann Davison is toast. Let's see what the primary results are, right? Before we start putting people in their political graves. I actually think both in the Sarah Nelson city council race and in Ann Davison city attorney race, it's possible that these candidates are doing better than the conventional wisdom expects. That's the NPI polling seemed to hint at that. Now, it's hard to make much of a judgment out of this NPI polling because the undecided numbers are so high, and it's very hard to gauge how are those undecided folks going to break. If they're if they're like, we're not on board with the incumbent undecided voters, then 30% is a terrible number to have going, you know, coming out of the, if Ann Davidson ends up at 30% coming out of the primary, she is toast, right? I mean, but we don't know. We will get a result on Tuesday or in the subsequent days after Tuesday, and we'll see what the numbers actually are. I would not write Ann Davidson's political obituary quite yet, or any of anyone's political obituary quite yet. Let's see what the primary numbers show. Going back to the lawsuit, yeah, the timing of it is eyebrow raising. I think Bruce Harrell was there just as much as Ann Davidson. And look, there is some real substance to this lawsuit. I mean, these executive orders do directly target blue cities like Seattle for their policies to try to cut off funding that has already been allocated by Congress on the basis of, you know, executive fiat. So I think there's a legitimate legal case to be made that this funding has been appropriated by Congress, which controls those purse strings, and should be dispersed. And there's real money at stake, including, my understanding, it's several hundred, $300 million of transportation money in particular that is at stake if these executive orders are upheld.
The transportation funding in the B&O tax, Rob Sacca added that spending category. And, you know, while I do think it is quite far afield of the purpose, you know, the original purpose, I mean, I think that's why he did it. And he was actually at the press conference about the lawsuit.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's real both legal issues here about the overreach of the Trump administration, as well as fiscal issues for the city of Seattle that are in play. As you said, this is what Trump is doing that is causing all this consternation. And if it actually stands and goes through, we're talking about real tangible loss of revenue. So I think it's perfectly legitimate for the city attorney and the mayor and council members to stand there and say, we got to try to reverse this or you know, defeat it. So,
oh, are you sure, Sandy? If that's so weird, because you were just saying that they shouldn't worry about things until they happen.
Well, I mean, these executive orders have happened, and they're trying to cut off existing funding.
Now, yeah, but that funding still exists. I don't know, man. Like, maybe we should just wait and see, just like with the budget.
Well, they haven't been implemented because other lawsuits have also been filed that have stayed the implementation of these things. But as I said also earlier, the prospective cuts are real, right? And so I do think there need to be actions taken to try to stop the progressive prospective cuts, including legal action. And so I think it's appropriate for them to do it. The timing of it is a little bit like, huh, you had to do it like 4 days before the primary?
I wonder, you know, privately, like, how realistic is it that the city's actually going to prevail here? Or are we just wasting money for political reasons? Like, I'm not saying they shouldn't sue. I wonder if Ann Davidson thinks she's going to prevail, I guess is my question.
I think she has every reason to believe. Look, based on the fact that they have a legal case about the overreach of the Trump administration based on, like, how federal appropriations work.
It doesn't seem like this Supreme Court has been terribly favorable to cities like Seattle on issues like this. So,
yeah, I mean, I just think speculating about Ann Davidson's secret state of mind is kind of irrelevant when you have the lawsuit to look at, and it looks like, you know, a pretty strong case. Again, none of us are lawyers, so we can all be full of shit.
But you just called it a strong case. You must be a lawyer.
None of us are lawyers, but Democratic attorney generals, including our own attorney general, Nick Brown, have filed a series of lawsuits against the Trump administration for precisely these kinds of executive orders seeking to cut funding to blue jurisdictions, blue states, blue cities on what they are arguing is constitutionally dubious grounds, right? There's been a whole body of legal work. And in fact, they're winning a lot of these decisions at lower courts. The reasons those executive orders have not gone into effect yet is because federal judges have weighed in to say that the people making these arguments about that Trump can't just unilaterally cut off funding that Congress has appropriated is an overreach, an executive overreach by the Trump administration. So I think there's already a body of legal evidence to suggest that this is not a frivolous lawsuit and that there is reason to make this legal argument to try to preserve this funding for the city of Seattle.
That's it for another exciting, friendly episode of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde. She's Eric C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kashyap. Our editor is Quinn Waller. And thanks, everybody, so much for listening.